This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Live from the Lincoln Theater, this is the West Wing Weekly. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway.
And I'm Joshua Molina. We're excited to be here in D.C. If you've been following us on social media, you know that we've been on tour for about a week and a half. I can't speak for Rishi, but I'm wearing not a single article of clean clothing. And also, it was nice to meet literally each and every one of you before the show.
Today, we're talking about episode 22 from season 4. It's called Commencement.
It was written by Aaron Sorkin. It was directed by Alex Graves, and it first aired on May 7th, 2003.
Before we get into the details of the episode, here's a little overview. So the first time we were introduced to Zoe Bartlett back in season 1, episode 5, she was about to start school at Georgetown. And in this, the penultimate episode of season 4, Zoe's graduating. President Bartlett is the commencement speaker, and his angst over Zoe's impending 3-month trip to France with Jean-Paul is spilling into his approach to the speech, and Will has to help him sort through it. The staff finds out the truth about Abdul Sharif, and it turns out the world's about to as well, thanks to Danny Kincannon, who's discovered it on his own. CJ keeps him at bay with the news that 5 terrorists are on the loose, and revealing the news to the public would be a threat to national security. Charlie tries to send Zoe off with a bottle of champagne and a sense of closure, and Toby, sweet Toby, proposes to Andy.
This can't be the NBC synopsis.
I'm sorry, it's so long. There's a lot that happens in this episode. Toby proposes to Andy with her dream house just before she goes into labor. But the night ends in horror when Zoe goes to a party at a club, gets drugged by Jean-Paul, and disappears, leaving behind her panic button, a dead Secret Service agent, and lots of questions.
What a delightful synopsis. Also, before we start, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that Ron Klain is here with us tonight. But the bad news is that Brad Whitford is also here with us tonight.
Ronald Klain, as you may know, he's been on the podcast before. He was a senior advisor to President Clinton, and he was the chief of staff to Vice Presidents Gore and Biden. And Bradley Whitford, you may know, he played Josh Lyman. Let's please give a big round of applause to both of them.
That was all plain applause.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Wow, can we do a second take where you mean it? We're delighted to have you guys. I actually meant it.
I didn't believe it.
I can't do sincere.
No.
So one of the reasons we're so excited to have Ron here on stage with us is because this episode deals so much with the possibility of finding a new vice president, and as chief of staff to 2 vice presidents and having served on the committee to look for a vice president, he's going to help us fill in some of the details about the accuracy or inaccuracy in this episode. And really, in general, we're going to ask him a lot of questions about how things work in real life.
So, Ron, how do things work in real life?
Well, the one thing I know for sure is this is the closest I'm getting to the actual West Wing until 2021. So,
is Biden going to run?
Yeah, I think that comes in like the second 30 minutes of this podcast.
Very special guest.
So, in this episode, things start off in a place that we're used to, more or less, a day in the life of the president and senior staff dealing with the day-to-day issues of running the country from behind the scenes, a mix of politics and an off-screen geopolitical situation, a little bit of office romance and family relationships, but then it ends in a place where we have never been before. And this episode is kind of shocking to watch for all of the 4 years leading up to it. Brad, when you first read the script for this one, did you feel as surprised as I think the audience ends up feeling?
I remember, there's like ecstasy and drugs, and it got weird at the end. I do remember that.
All right, well, before it gets weird, let's start at the beginning. The last episode, the episode prior to this, ends with the line, "We're going to need a new vice president." And that's right where this episode picks up. We see Josh pulling out dossiers. He's got a list of names, which, interestingly enough, has actual real-world politicians on the list. I'm talking about this like very quick montage that happens in the teaser. There's a shot, you know, where Josh writes "not ready" on the side of a piece of paper. It seems to be a list of artwork located in government buildings, and I would agree that none of those paintings are ready to be vice president.
Rishi watches The West Wing like it's the Zapruder film. He stops it and goes frame by frame.
Oh my it's God.
Well, because I want to see stuff like this. So two of the names that you do see on the list are Tom Harkin, who was a contender for VP in 2000, and...
You're not wooing for Tom Harkin. You're just, that's just a cry for attention.
He was the Iowa senator, junior senator. But the other name on the list that's from the real world is Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, which is an odd choice since he's a Republican.
We haven't gotten a reaction like that since I mentioned Brad's name in Dublin.
It's true. Josh said,
I mentioned,
this episode was submitted as part of Bradley Whitford's nomination for Outstanding Supporting Actor, and the crowd booed.
I think it was just a way of expressing love for me.
Wow. Okay. Okay, Ireland.
Josh also has another... This is also a fraction of a second long, but I paused it. He has a seating plan of the Senate, and if you look closely at the seating plan, you can see that in the West Wing universe, Washington, D.C. actually has two seats in the Senate. Congratulations, except in the real world where you still don't. Sorry.
And don't your license plates say taxation without representation?
Yes. The most badass license plates.
That is badass. And accurate.
Trump will fix it.
You notice how if somebody says Bartlett, we always jump and go, President Bartlett? But with Trump, yeah. Not an issue.
Funny, I thought the reaction in this room might be more mixed than that.
We love you all, though.
So, Ron, Tom Harkin was an actual, you know, I saw on Wikipedia, it shows that Tom Harkin was a...
Wow, you dug
deep. Wikipedia? Really?
No stone unturned for all of Hrishikesh.
It's the old 15-minute podcast prep.
On Wikipedia, in the list of contenders for the vice presidential nomination, Tom Harkin is listed along with, you know, it says that here are the top six, here were the others. Eventually, of course, it was actually Joe Lieberman. I thought it was interesting that even on a place like Wikipedia, you can see who was the shortlist. That's not private. Is that common that everybody knows who's up for the job?
Yeah, I mean, after the fact in 92, 2000, 2004, 2008, the list has come out. The campaigns have put out the list to show who's under consideration. Sometimes that gives someone a political boost. Their name was on the list, shows the diversity of the list. Not really sure why Tom Harkin was on there, but you know, it generally it's part of the politics of it. But after the fact, and what's interesting to me about the scene where Josh is sorting this out is just how wide open it is. He's got pictures tacked to a bulletin board. Anyone who'd walk by his office would know who they were looking at. And you know, whenever I've worked on this, it's been super duper top secret, you know, spy cloak and dagger stuff as you're searching for a vice president. And not like faces up on the bulletin board. That's definitely not the way it's done.
But then afterwards, someone from the search committee leaks the list.
Then afterwards, they put out the full list and say, here's who everyone was considered.
They put it on Facebook and it's
exactly.
And all the senators and governors can say it was an honor just to be
considered. You bet, an honor. No one really wanted it. They just wanted to be considered.
Did Lieberman want it?
Lieberman wanted, you know, it's funny, in 2000...
It's the only name has gotten literally no reaction.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on. He's Jewish. I'll clap. Got something going for him.
Yeah. In 92, in fact, when we did this search, everyone involved in the search, while the search was going on, had, like, code names associated with them.
Was his Jew?
Well, he was in 2000. It was definitely not Jew.
The oldest code name of them all.
Al Gore wound up being the pick in 92, and his Secret Service code name ultimately became Sundance, you know, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And he used to joke that he used to say, Al Gore is so boring that his Secret Service code name is Al Gore. And but we, you know, assigned him all code names to try to keep it really hush-hush.
Actually, so here's a question I had about code names, because early on in this episode, Josh Lyman asks Tay Diggs, who's introduced as Wesley Davis.
He's great. Yeah.
Let's bring him out. Yeah, I've got a whole list of disappointments for you over the next hour, hour and a half.
So Josh asks Wesley what's going on, and he says,
I go to France tomorrow morning. I'm leading Book Bag's paparazzi patrol for 3 months.
And so, I know he's talking to Josh, so Josh knows the code names. But you have to wonder, if everybody knows everyone's code names, what's the point of a code name? It's not much of a code.
No, the Secret Service code names for these people are well-known and publicized once they get selected. And in fact, in the show, obviously Zoe's code name is Book Bag. Al Gore's oldest daughter, Karenna, they ask these people to pick their code name as soon as they're designated. So they pick Gore to be vice president. They go to the daughters. What do you want your code name to be? She was 18 or 19 at the time. And the nicknames have to begin with the same letter. So Gore, Sundance, Tipper, Skylark. They say, pick any word that begins with S. She picks Smurfette as her code name. You know, 8 years later, she's 30. She's a mom. She's like, my code name's still Smurfette. You know, like, how did I get out of this? So
you got to worry about those early tattoos.
Exactly. It's a bummer. It's a real bummer.
Is there a favorite code name that you've heard?
Vice President Biden was Celtic, which, you know, was kind of resonant. Yeah, and our current vice president is Hoosier. So, yeah, exactly.
As in, who's your boss and how'd he get his job?
Exactly. There you go. I'll just be here serving up the softballs for the rest of the night.
I appreciate it.
You didn't get a code name, did you?
No. When you're chief of staff to the vice president, you do not rate a code name. Let me assure you of that.
Ron, it's your special night. You can pick one now.
Smurfette, though, is taken.
It'll only last for the next hour or so, but what would you like? Come on.
Papa Smurf. I don't know.
Papa Smurf. All right, you got an hour and a half of regret coming up.
Are there people who get selected for vice president who don't want the job?
No, quite the contrary. People campaign very hard for it. They do what they can to try to get the job. It is obviously pretty significant and important job both in the government and sets up someone potentially to be the next president. Indeed, the episode before this, when Hoynes resigns, one thing they're struggling with is that they really expected him to be Bartlett's successor. And you see the president and Leo trying to talk him out of quitting and saying, like, you're going to be the next president. So people want the job because they think it's a path to the next job.
Well, here's my question. At the teaser or the cold open ends, just before the credits, we get Josh, inexpertly played by Brad Whitford, asking Charlie, what would you think of this guy? And then it's a little newspaper clipping of Leo with the president. And would it be a demotion to go from being chief of staff, where you have maybe more to do, to becoming the vice president?
Yeah, I don't know about a demotion. It would definitely be a big change. I also do love that scene, right? Because it's like, if Josh doesn't pin Leo's picture to the board, no one will know who he is. You know, it seems kind of like dramatic. But look,
I haven't criticized your politics at all.
Yeah. Well, you know. But, you know, Dick Cheney was chief of staff to President Ford and went on to become vice president, obviously, under President Bush. And then when Rahm Emanuel became White House chief of staff, he brought in all his predecessors for some advice. And he goes around the table, says, what's your best piece of advice? And Cheney was there as a former chief of staff and goes around the table. And Cheney says to Rahm, beware the vice president. So, it's a tricky switch from chief of staff to vice president for sure.
How do you ask Rahm Emanuel what time is it?
How?
Rahm, what time is it, or should I just go f*** myself? It's a Rahm Emanuel joke.
I'd heard that Josh was based somewhat in part on Rahm Emanuel. And have you had much interaction with him? Did you ever meet him and draw any inspiration from either things you'd read about him or learned in person?
Yeah, I read about I think there was Begala in there. I actually pushed because Rahm was a dancer, took ballet. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Well,
And you can do a split.
I sure can. I remember talking about that. And there was the sending of the fish, which I believe was a ROM
Yes,
event.
Yes.
What's the sending of the fish?
To one of his political opponents, he sent a dead fish head. You know, kind of like the horse head in The Godfather. Yeah. But
the live fish heads are so much messier.
Yeah. But smaller and easier to mail, perhaps.
True, I think he got kicked out of his office and had a card table in the hallway.
That happened. And he also, you know, it was a lot of fun to work with Rahm, that's for sure.
Well, how much do you see of Rahm Emanuel in Josh Lyman?
Some. I mean, I think, obviously, as Brad alluded to, Paul Begala also was counselor to the president. There were a lot of people who had that role. And I think the character of Josh is kind of a composite of all that. And, you know, but has a... you know, kind of a leadership role that none of the counselors had. So
simmering sexuality.
And a simmering sexuality.
With just a hint of Elephant Man.
Well, if we were on HBO, you would have seen a lot more Rahm.
But, you know, when Josh, in that scene, pins Leo's photo to the board, as he does it, he says, "Not that I'm looking for this promotion," and says maybe Leo should be vice president. So there's a hint of ambition in Josh, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, there is another time when Leo's name is floated as a possible vice presidential running mate, or candidate, running mate, really, when back in season 3, there's one episode, Stirred, where the staff talk about the electoral math, really, of potentially dropping Hoynes from the ticket and who they might get to run in his place. Because Bruno points out that Hoynes, it's not so much that Hoynes hurts the ticket, but there's a possibility of someone else helping the ticket more, and that's Fitz Wallace.
Nobody knows what you're talking about.
No, I'm kidding. No, they do. No,
this
they
audience do. Really does. Do. I promise you these folks do.
And he thinks Hoynes hurts us there.
You know, I actually think it's... I actually think it's interesting because Hoynes is a dismissible... he clearly is... not a partner. And it sort of mirrors the time, it was really with Gore that the vice president became kind of a counselor, right?
Yeah, I mean, it really started with Mondale, was the first modern vice president, first vice president to have an office in the White House. Before Walter Mondale, no vice president had an office. He had even had an office in the White House. And then the role kind of grew and grew and grew. And Gore, I think, took it one step farther and really was a true partner. Hoynes is interesting that way because in the first season, it's pretty clear Bartlett doesn't like him. He basically says, "I was forced to take you for political reasons, don't really like you." And he's not included. I mean, it's hard to think of a picture of the Clinton-Gore years where a significant thing happened and Gore isn't standing there right next to Clinton. And of course, that's not the relationship between Bartlett and Hoynes at all. In fact, I went and looked. Hoynes only makes one other appearance in all of season 4 other than the episode in which he quits. So he clearly is not at the president's side and involved in all the meetings in the way that Vice President Gore was or Vice President Biden was later after that.
I read somewhere there's an old joke about a mother who had two sons that were never heard from again. One was lost at sea and the other became vice president.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is a job that historically has gotten no respect. John Nance Garner, who was FDR's vice president, said it was a job that wasn't worth a warm bucket of spit, and spit was not the word he used. And but I think in recent years, it's gotten more prominence, more importance, and played a larger role.
And constitutionally, the job is?
Wait for the president to die.
That's
that
it,
is
right?
The job.
And preside over the Senate if there's a tie.
And vote if there's a tie.
And am I wrong, or the vice president presides over the Senate, but unless there's a tie, he can't even weigh in. He can't speak as part of the debate.
Only gets to vote if there's a tie. Joe Biden was vice president for 8 years, never voted once. 0 votes, 8 years. So, you know.
I would love that job.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody always disparages it. It sounds great to me. Yeah.
There's one little part at the beginning in this teaser that I love where Josh is digging through all these dossiers and he's working through all these files. And then Charlie comes in and says,
"The president wants to know if we still have the vetting files from 5 years ago."
And Josh says,
"For vice president, you mean?"
"Yeah."
Like, as if it's coming out of the blue. All right, that was it.
Well, we've decided, I think. Well, we decided in conversation with Eli Addy in London that Aaron puts in lots of little places where the audience can catch up in case they're behind.
Right.
It's one of the reasons why half the time someone says something, the other person says, "I'm sorry," and they repeat the first thing they said. The audience can catch its breath.
Yeah.
Rationalized.
One of the other things that happens in this episode that I didn't talk about in the synopsis, the paragraphs long synopsis, is the dynamic between Amy and Donna. It's all about an interaction that we never actually see, where Amy has offended Josh and she's trying to get Donna to be an intermediary to get back into Josh's good graces, and Donna is not having it.
What I like is that essentially they have three attempts at the same scene. It's written very similarly. They have the same information. They're basically passing back and forth.
Yeah, it's not a lot of headway.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's in terrific performances that we see that there's really a whole other conversation taking place beneath the same dialogue they keep rattling at each other.
Yeah, it's true. And the Amy-Donna scene, I mean, there's just, the text basically stays the same, but, you know, you get a little bit more of an elevation of the tension in the subtext, and the subtext is so thick between the two of them. I love that, you know, there's one part where in the second go-round, when Amy tries again, she comes up and she gives a little compliment to Donna. They give each other these little compliments, this exchange.
Donna, I was just coming to see you. I love what you're wearing.
You too.
And this is like the most loaded, just lies, lying at each other. And it reminded me of this. There's a great line in The Importance of Being Earnest that it reminded me of from the movie version.
I bet you anything you like, half an hour after they've met, they will be calling each other sister.
Women only do that when they've called each other a lot of other things first.
They're being so nice to each other. I love what you met. You know, I love what you're wearing. And then, but then as the episode gets deeper and deeper, the sort of layers of subtext build up and then fall away eventually until
Amy just says it.
Yeah. Donna says, she tells her, you have to get Josh. You know, like there's a dividing line and she puts herself in it and she puts Amy on the other side of it.
And then she even does the passive aggressive thing of saying, I'm not saying you don't get him.
Right.
Even though I just implied it just pretty strongly.
There's been this kind of unwritten rule for 4 years of how we kind of witness and interact with the Donna-Josh relationship. You know, it's just...
Jesus. Go ahead.
It's just below the... No, I'm saying it's just below... You know, it's very rarely put on the surface. As much as it's clear to everyone what's happening, it's rarely actually the thing that's being discussed. And it's kind of lived like that for a long time. But here, Amy really, at that point, she breaks the rules. So first Donna says this.
No, I understood what you were saying. Josh worked for Heinz for a long time. There was a reason.
He left him.
And if you think that was easy, you're crazy. Josh doesn't leave people.
I get that he was close to Hoynes. What I don't get...
You have to get Josh.
I think Donna is doing this really subtle, passive-aggressive thing of using Hoynes when she says, you know, oh, he doesn't leave people. She's reminding Amy the reason why they aren't together, why they're no longer together, is it was Amy's choice. And if she hadn't done that, they would still be together. And now that they're not, Donna has no obligations to her whatsoever except for professional courtesy. And then finally, Amy just drops the bombshell.
I didn't mean to say that you don't get him.
Are you in love with Josh?
And there it is.
The techno vibe out of context, a little weird. Okay, we're in a montage there, right?
Yeah, it's very explicit. It was surprising for me to see it again.
Yeah, I think it goes along with a lot of what happens in this episode, which is that rules are broken left and right. So many of the sort of conventions that we know about the West Wing are thrown out of the window in this episode.
Well, and Aaron, as I don't think we knew it then, but Aaron was getting right running for the stable. And so I think that there was a certain recklessness to the writing that maybe, you know, you wouldn't see like first or second year. It's just like, ah, fuck it.
Yeah, this will be someone else's problem soon.
Yeah.
But I think it even manifests in ways like the end title card, you know, the very familiar fade to black, and then the executive producers listed, instead of going to black in this episode, it goes to white. Never seen that before. It's, I don't know.
Are you okay?
I'm not, honestly. This episode, you know...
It unnerved you.
It does.
This episode is an anomaly in many ways. I mean, it's very different from...
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and the last 10 minutes, you've got the Massive Attack song playing to just make you feel incredibly uncomfortable the whole time. And it works on me.
Well,
it,
I can see how, especially for you, who so deeply immersed in every episode, this is a really disturbing... sort of loss of gravity in the world you're familiar with.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. No, it's unnerving. I understand it now.
There are, now we're jumping way ahead, but at the very end of the episode, you know, we have Leo running. First of all, Leo running, that's weird.
There's something heartbreaking about the John Spencer run, too.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's something big is up.
And then to make it even weirder, they put it in slow motion.
They might have had to. They're like, this doesn't look right. Slow it down and see how that looks. Better.
And it's also intercut with these crazy black and white shots of, you know, extreme close-up of Louis Buñuel style of Zoe's eye. The whole thing is really unsettling and weird. And it starts to feel like, you know, are you watching The West Wing, in fact?
See, I love this kind of... I like the... how things run, small stakes, quotidian episodes. But because there are so many, it's also fun when there's something like this that is, I feel like it's been earned by the rest of the series, that occasionally you can have suspense and you can have surprise and you can have, they're much more personal, many more personal stories in this episode than you normally find maybe in a season of The West Wing.
I remember Alex, who's extraordinary.
Alex Graves?
Yeah, director on this. Yes. And he was always like, you know, he would get very excited about what he was doing. And he was thrilled, to be able to play around in ways that you couldn't.
And I think he killed it. I think he did a great job. This episode visually is pretty stunning.
Yes.
I think they're clapping for me just for saying that.
What about Taye Diggs? Did you know that he was going to be coming on before? Was there any kind of discussion about... who might play that role, or were you surprised?
No, I just remember being really happy it was him, and he was great, and he was nice, and just fantastic.
Did you know him before? Had you ever worked with him on anything?
No.
I feel like...
Me neither.
Thank you, Papa Smurf.
I felt like it was... They were finally kind of making up for the departure of Rob Lowe a little bit.
Was that an insult to me? You mean by bringing someone else handsome on the show?
It is.
Oh,
what I
you
meant.
Do mean that.
But it is what
it's
I meant.
It's pretty clear
but
what
I
he
didn't
was
mean
saying.
It as an insult. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I love how we're totally ignoring Ron Klain like he's chief of staff for the vice president or something.
Beat me too.
Totally fair.
A lot of meetings like this, right?
Actually, I do have a question for you, Ron. If Al Gore had won in 2000.
And he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you have had Leo's job?
No way to know, but, and then if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016, which she did, yeah, no way to know. So, no way to know. Sad.
You don't have you don't pre-print the business cards.
You don't pre-print the business cards, no. Definitely not.
Oh, is there superstition against discussing possible staffing before the jobs won?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that would seem to be both really bad form and super bad luck to count your chickens before they hatch.
Right.
And particularly, in 2000, where, I spent 36 days in Florida as general counsel of the recount and kind of fighting that out every single day.
My grandparents spent 36 years in Florida.
Yeah, well.
Just as an aside.
Yeah. It would have been better if they'd learned how to punch those ballots accurately, but...
Wow.
Oh, sure. It was my grandparents' fault.
Let me put it this way. It was somebody's grandparents' fault. That's for sure.
I'm comfortable with.
Stop blaming the Jews.
That's a code name for Jews.
Yeah. It was rough. No question.
Back to Taye Diggs.
Okay. We'll add the segues later.
when we meet the
What are you doing? Like a Billy Joel imitation? You're like... Like,
sing us a song, you're the piano man. Now I'm going to take my
Here's
hat
why.
Off. Bald spot.
That's preemptive.
Okay, here we go.
Exactly.
Speaking of bald spots, when we meet Taye Diggs...
Yes. That's by choice.
Who wore it better? Taye Diggs.
The Secret Service agents put on a little show for the president, you know, about he's really concerned with overwhelming force. And they do a weird little routine. That whole scene is kind of strange.
Oh, yeah, the little demonstration?
Yeah, they ask Wesley to attack, and then Molly comes and flips him. And then Zoe comes out, and she says, get off of Wesley. It's a little weird. Zoe feels almost like a princess ordering her royal guard around there.
Yeah, I think you're right. Also, wasn't Molly on Ellie's detail, we find out?
Yes.
But he walks in, and he's like, are you friends of Zoe's?
Yeah. Is well, he's not so good with names and faces.
Right. Neither was Martin. He called Allison the tall one for 7 years.
And now we're going to take a quick break.
And now, back to the show.
Josh, you had something about the insert shot when they're showing the badges?
Oh, each of the three shows his or her badge. And then there's a weird, the camera lingers on the last female Secret Service agent's badge.
I think it's actually supposed to be lingering on the holster in the gun to show.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
To show that
that's why he's in charge. I watched it like 9 times. I am not getting this. It's a badge. Okay. You just set me up, by the way. I'm like, didn't you have an incredibly dumb question that I'm then going to answer and make you look really dumb by answering? Can't believe I just fell for that.
We'll cut it in post.
No, we won't.
We won't. But then we get this father-daughter moment between the president and Zoe, where it's very, very sweet and incredibly patriarchal, where he says that all daughters should just stay at home playing Yahtzee if he had his way.
A candy striper?
Or surfing. You could spend the summer working in a pet shop. We could play Yahtzee and watch movies at night.
Dad, what fantasy is it that's going through your head right now?
What daughters would do their whole lives if I had my way.
It's one of those ones where you're like, oh, and then you kind of shrug and...
Yeah. I think that's especially creepy with Donald Trump and Ivanka in the White House right now.
Wow.
Papa Smurf kills again. That's good. You know, actually, I think during this clip, I also love the way that it is staged and acted and the way that Alex shoots it, because Taye Diggs is talking to the president and he's involved in the scene, and then when they have this moment together, he's kind of in the background and you see him in profile. He actually just turns away in order to give privacy for that moment to the extent that he can.
Yeah.
I like that little shot.
They give the space for the patriarchal condescension. They're trained.
This episode is actually not one that I have watched many, many times. It's a hard episode for me to watch. I think mainly... It is. It's not.
You just put it in front of you and you look at it. Same difficulty level for all episodes. Tell us why. Weird.
I only got 10 minutes in and then I had to stop. How many times have you seen this episode?
I think I've seen, well, now.
In your life?
I think 3.
How many times have you seen Two Cathedrals?
A lot more.
So let's dig into this a little bit.
I think part of the reason why this episode is so hard for me to watch is because the Toby storyline is just brutal. This moment where he doesn't want to tell the rest of the staff that he's got this house thing going on, but then they find out, it just makes the moment when she says no, even it would be painful on its own, but when he proposes, you start to remember that everybody is going to be asking him eventually, how did it go? How did it go? But in the scene itself, I appreciate how quickly Andy lets him down.
She's wonderful in this.
She's great, yeah. Bird York. But it's just brutal. I feel like this is maybe the most brutal thing that Aaron has ever written. Like, I think this is much more brutal than the actual death of Simon Donovan in season 3, because...
What a romantic guy.
Okay.
Actual death?
Here's my reasons. Simon Donovan, we'd only gotten to know him for a few episodes. This is one of our heroes who we've had for four seasons. We've been watching him, and the love story between him, or what was apparently a one-sided love story between him and Andy, it was this sweet thing for so long. And the other thing is that the Simon Donovan assassination is something that happens with actions. You know, it's stage direction, it's wordless. And Aaron, of course, is at like his most deadly when he's writing. And so he's using like the full extent of his powers here to make us watch someone just get their heart torn apart.
I agree with you, and I'm not being ironic. Richard it's a perfect use of sort of exploitation of Richard, who is complicated and can seem, you know, sort of defensive emotionally, but is truly this dilated, sweet heart in there.
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
Guy.
Yeah. Not like you. No, I'm sorry. It's so awful, I can't even get through a sentence. No, but Richard is extraordinary in this, and to see that character take that emotional risk and get swatted down.
To me, it's already heartbreaking just when he gets out of the car. Just seeing Toby in the suburbs is somehow just a little
feels bit wrong.
My God, he'll do anything for this woman.
Let's listen to that, this roughest moment. I know.
We're here.
Why? You're just too sad for me, Toby.
What?
You're too sad for me. You're just sad. You bring the sadness home with you, and you're sad.
I'm not sad.
I'm just going to play a little something here from The Simpsons.
You can actually pinpoint the second when his heart rips in half.
And it's, I mean, a testament to Richard Schiff that you can. You see that moment, and then he doesn't even really get to mourn it, because then she goes and her water breaks, and she has what's the most miraculously quick and easy pregnancy in history, or labor.
Do we have the last little bit that he says?
Did you feel this way when we were married?
Come on,
I mean, it's not just now.
Come on, I'm sorry about all that. I'm really pregnant. Please, I take it all back.
Really? Come on. Did you feel this way when we were married, that I was sad?
No. I'm gonna go sit in the car. My ankles are starting.
Did my friends feel like that?
That's the part I find super heartbreaking. Did my friends feel like that?
Why's that?
Just because I have no friends. No. because he's now internalized what she had to say, and he's experiencing it mentally in the rest of his life. In other words, is this how everybody pictures me? And the way Aaron writes, your work people and your friends and your colleagues, and it's such a bond, just that would be the utter sort of destruction of his world. Okay, this marriage is not going to happen, the second marriage, but is that how my friends feel? I just find it very touching.
Right, and it's the kind of nightmare reduction of that character to a sort of one-dimensional perception, which would be very upsetting to Toby.
How do we get back now?
I know.
This is so sad.
I know. Is this worse than Florida?
It's getting there. It's getting there.
The thing that makes this episode so crazy is that isn't even the emotional climax of this episode.
It's a Dante poem. You think you're at the bottom, but you're not.
It's true.
I think I can get us back with a really light, inconsequential nitpick, which is there's a subplot about Charlie's having buried a cheap bottle of champagne at the National Arboretum.
Yeah, what am I doing walking around there? Yeah.
Yeah. It's buried, he remembers, near a specific kind of plant.
Oh, that's right.
We have a clip.
A note fell out of my wallet yesterday, and I couldn't remember what it... 5-7, 10 p.m., Peonia, Japonica, Bamboo.
Japonica? Is that a Jewish holiday? It's Japonica, as in of or pertaining to Japan. Why did Dulé say Japonica?
Because he's anti-Semitic.
Just to be sure, I think we have.
Oh, yeah.
I pulled this clip.
Japonica.
Okay.
Some diction problems from Dulé Jill.
It's good. And where do you guys, do you remember where you filmed that? That was not in D.C. That was not, in fact, at the National Arboretum.
It was at the Huntington Gardens.
Oh, right.
Near my home in Pasadena.
Which has a beautiful Happiness garden.
It has. Yeah. It's the Happiness part of town.
Very picturesque.
There's that beautiful bridge that's in the shot, and that's how I could tell that it was the Huntington, because that thing is so distinctive. It's called the Moon Bridge.
Big carp.
Yeah.
A lot of carp.
You know, we talked in the last episode about Richard's attempt to try and win Andy over in part by eating salad. He talks a little bit about the salad in this episode too. And I feel like there's a little echo of it here when Zoe says to Charlie, they're in the Happiness garden, and she says,
"You're such a good guy. You were raised in horror. What is it along the way that made you a good guy?"
"I try to eat right."
It's the power of the salad.
Speaking of, as we weren't, of... I said we add the segues later. Of Elizabeth Moss.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's how I did it. Garden, Moss, Elizabeth.
Yes.
Yourselves. You've been working with her again, have you not?
It made me really jappy to work with her again. That could be bad. That could be bad.
Yeah.
Context. You are working, are you not, on The Handmaid's Tale
season
2?
I am. I was just working with her a couple nights ago, and she's lovely, and I'm incredibly proud of her. What was she, 17 when she... Yeah, she didn't ask about you. But she is amazing. And she's really a producer on that show.
Is that true? Are you able to give us any inside info and a little tease, a little something, a little taste? No spoilers, but...
I'm a commander.
They're like, you remember Joseph Fiennes? And they're like, let's go even creepier season 2.
And I hope you think it's a little less sexist than Josh.
I'm just wondering if after Get Out, are you now going to be typecast as a racist? Because that's a rough turn.
My entire career is the wrong side of history. Actually, Jordan at a thing said that they asked why he cast me in that movie, and he said, I just thought it'd be really funny to see Josh Lyman remove the top of someone's head.
And it was. Ron, when
oh yeah, it comes to me now, sure.
Segway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thanks.
Speaking of racists, Ron.
all bets are off here, people.
Yes. Speaking of removing people's heads, I thought that was where you were headed.
That would have been the more obvious one. I like to go more subtle. There's this moment when we start to get into this plot about the missing container ship and the missing Bahi operatives.
For those listening at home, Brad just assaulted me.
It's kind of a good thing I'm a lawyer, because I think Brad is going to need one by the end of this podcast. So I'm like right here for you. So it's good.
Well, Leo,
anonymous client number 2.
Where were we?
We were in the Situation Room. Leo asks what the rules are in questioning foreign nationals. And he sort of asks the room generally, because Nancy asks, she tells him that they have a well-lit room for the inquiries, and he asks why they might need that. And then he hears that it's for sleep deprivation. He kind of looks away for a second and says, all right. And I feel like that moment, that all right, is a really loaded one, especially for somebody like Leo, who was in Vietnam and knew what the consequences were if he were to get shot down. You know, now they're talking about what are the legal rules of being able to question foreign nationals. And she says that they can hold them up to 7 days and deprive them of sleep. Is this kind of ethical, shaky ground the kind of place that you were you ever in conversations like this where these are rules that are, you know, they're following the rules? He asks what the rules are, and she says this is allowed, where it's
allowed, but it's still wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to remember, but the not that point. That, you know, the West Wing feels like a story about largely the Clinton presidency in some ways, but it's filmed, this part of it, during the Bush years. And right. This is really the Bush era kind of coming into the show, and questions about interrogation and things like that that were litigated under President Bush and in some ways we're still dealing with today. And, you know, I thought what I found interesting about that is there's no way that conversation happens for the first time on the spot in the Situation Room in the middle of a crisis. They've been dealing with this terrorist threat for virtually the entire season. And, you know, this would have been the subject of a lot of conversation, a lot of meetings, a lot of working out the details before they got in the middle of this particular situation.
And so the situation, just to cover everything, there's a container ship that's missing one container. And there are also these five missing Bahi operatives. And there's this chatter, there's increased chatter. And so there are all these reasons why they're nervous and keeping a more vigilant eye. But there's also a possibility, you know, the FBI is all over it. The ship is in Portland. They're all over it in Oregon. And they are trying to contain the situation, so to speak. And but it might all be over a typo, it turns out. And so they still don't know where the missing terrorists are. And Leo asks for a quick around the room, and we actually hear him say, "What kind of day has it been?"
Which is usually the finale of any Aaron Sorkin show, right?
The title? Or at least the first season.
I don't know. I don't watch the stuff that closely.
And part of what the pressure on this whole situation comes from Danny, because he has the truth about Sharif, and he's being pressured in return by the White House not to publish it because of the security concerns. I asked Zeke Miller is the White House reporter for the AP, and he's been a friend of the podcast, and I was hoping that he might be able to join us for a little bit tonight, but he's part of the White House press corps, so he's on a plane right now to Florida with Donald Trump. But he did send me some insights into the sort of the Danny side of this episode. I don't know if you remember when Zeke was on the show before, he kind of expressed how unbelievable the CJ Danny romance stuff was and how just unethical it was and not cool for a White House press secretary or a reporter to have that kind of relationship. And so I'd kind of pegged him as a bit of a CJ Danny hater, but he says that in this episode, this is actually his favorite moment between the two of them. Here's what he said. He said that it normally violates every rule in the journalism handbook, but this one provides a really accurate window into the relationship between a White House press corps and the administration, notwithstanding the sleeping on the press secretary's couch. Is that the relationship we see here is adversarial but also professional, with both sides believing they're acting in the public's best interests. It may be the White House's job to keep sensitive things concealed and the press's job to uncover them, but it's both their jobs to consider the fallout. Effective White Houses and reporters tend to navigate these issues without it becoming personal, which is another theme here. And then he gave a recent example of how this plays out in real life. When the US, France, and the UK considered and then ultimately bombed Syria last week, every press outlet was deploying reporters to try and figure out when that might happen and what exactly might happen. And some parts of this work are conveyed off the record. Like, there was guidance from the White House last Thursday that there was no need to cancel dinner plans because of some imminent action. But on Friday, they were told very unofficially to stick around. No one went out and reported it, but they hung around and started working on their stories. And then later, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told reporters what was happening, stressing it couldn't be reported until the president began speaking for security reasons. And that baseline of trust, which isn't always there with this or any White House, is critical for both sides to do their jobs. When it comes to trading up on story for another exclusive, which is what Danny does, that's also a hallmark of good reporting, especially at the White House. And so for all these reasons, this is his favorite Danny-CJ interaction of the series. It's perfectly spot on.
Thank you, Zeke Miller. I have another small thing. There's a mention over and over of threat condition Bravo.
Yeah.
A phrase that apparently literally everybody's familiar with. And it made me, anybody else a fan of the American version of The Office? So threat condition Bravo made me think of Michael Scott's pet film project.
After 3 years of writing, 1 year of shooting, 4 years of reshooting, and 2 years of editing, I have finally completed my movie, Threat Level Midnight.
It's a great episode. Also, you mentioned Danny's falling asleep on CJ's couch. Whose fault was that?
Carol's.
Carol? O'Carroll, why'd you let him in the office?
Hey.
I think I want them to be together.
Oh, cute. It's a romantic thing. There is, by the way, I notice, I don't even know what it is, but as CJ leaves the office at the end of that scene, she gives you some sort, there's some sort of little interaction between the two of you. There's life still going on there, which I love. You guys have a real relationship.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. And I'm so excited that you're all here in my new town.
That's right.
That's right. You went from L.A. How soon after The West Wing ended did you move to D.C.?
You're asking me to do math now? I came here about 4 years ago now.
Wow.
Which I can't believe. It's flown by. But I came here to work at Justice for Vets. And I'm still here.
It's been awesome learning about Justice for Vets to begin with, and then sort of hearing about all of the great work that's been done, and then how things have been developing over even just the 2 years since we started the show. What's going on now?
I'm really excited, and this whole community, the West Wing Weekly podcast community, and you guys have been so incredibly supportive, and everyone at the West Wing has been so supportive of Justice for Vets, and I'm so excited that we have expanded the courts. There are now over 350 veterans treatment courts across the country.
It's awesome.
There are hundreds more in different stages of planning and implementation, and I'm excited because I am now heading up a new initiative called Advancing Justice. And I'm not leaving Justice for Vets, I'm just expanding my profile. So in addition to fighting for veterans treatment courts, I'm now gonna be fighting for treatment courts for everyone. So every person in need. And we're also gonna be taking on larger criminal justice reform issues. I'm excited, I'm really excited because we have a report coming out this summer that will tackle racial and ethnic disparities in the courts, and I think that's a needed report. And I think I mentioned to you a story about a woman that is a graduate of a drug court that I wanted to share because she also sent me a text that I wanted to read to you all, but she gave me permission to use her name, but it's Chelsea, and she's from Boone County, West Virginia, which is the epicenter of the opioid crisis. And she took her first pill in high school at a party, and within months she was using every day and stealing to support her habit. And she was arrested many times. Her last arrest, she was facing 20 years in jail. Young woman facing 20 years. And luckily for Chelsea, there was a drug treatment court where she lived in Boone County, and she was able to get into that court program where she received, just like veterans treatment courts, she received treatment and accountability through the court system. She met regularly with her case manager, and she met all her obligations to the court, and she graduated from that program. She enrolled in college. She got her degree in psychology. She went and got a master's degree in social work, and she is now a treatment provider in the very same drug court that saved her life. Okay, that's Alice and Janney calling me. I was about to read you.
Answer it.
Okay, you're on speakerphone, and there's a lot of people here. So don't say anything you don't want people to hear.
Hey, it's Brad. And Melina, how are you? Did the Oscar change you?
Wait a minute.
Here.
What is happening?
Surprise guest, Alice and Janney, everyone.
That's really funny.
It was a surprise even to her.
Yes. What are you wearing?
Well, right now I have one piece on, but I can't decide.
Is it one piece?
Yeah, it's one piece. Okay. Here's Melissa.
Hey, I will call you later.
That was the best.
They really are friends.
They really are.
That's adorable.
Seriously, we are here at the West Wing Weekly Podcast, live here at 1200 feet. You are still on speakerphone. Okay, she's done. She says goodbye. All right, so getting back to the serious stuff.
Not that we have distorted our values with celebrity, but go ahead.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I really did get some of the best people in my life through this show, and I'm very grateful. And new ones, too. But I did want to read what Chelsea had sent, because I told her I would. And I think it's really valuable, because Chelsea went through a lot in her life, and this drug court saved her life. And she said, "Since being 9 years clean, I don't believe I ever would have made it here if my judge wouldn't have given me a second chance and entered me in the drug court program. Since then, my life has been completely different, and I just want to say to anyone out there still suffering from this horrible disease called addiction that there is hope, and don't give up. Even if you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, know that your life is worth fighting for, and someone out there is cheering you on to get help. You just have to take the first step."
And if people want to learn more about Justice for Vets and what you do, they can go to justiceforvets.org.
Thank you, Rishi. And you can find out about Advancing Justice on the justiceforvets.org website.
Great. It's called Advancing Justice is the new initiative.
Yeah, and we call it ajinitiative.org.
Okay, awesome.
And you just wrapped Scandal, right?
I also have some exciting things going on. I'm on Instagram now. Shut up.
But you're the Attorney General.
I mean, yeah, that's right. I only got 4 more days, but I'm the Attorney General of the United States.
There are a couple things that I want to make sure we talk about before we wrap things up. One thing that's crazy about watching this episode and seeing how the end plays out. Well, one, so we have this Massive Attack song that's playing for most of the end of the episode. And this feels so different from the rest of the show. It's so rare that there's a song, like an actual song being used in the show, like score. I mean, there are times... Of course, there's plenty of moments where Snuffy Walden's score helps dramatize the moments, but it's very rare that you hear a song. But then when you do, as you all know, usually it's like a cool dad jam.
Yeah, this will not be added to cool Sorkin jams on Spotify.
Yeah, there's nothing like fun and laid back and dad rocky about this. And it's just ratcheting up the tension, and it comes in and it starts playing so early that even before the actual scene of the kidnapping takes place or the discovery of the kidnapping occurs, you're just like filled with a sense of dread.
I remember Alex being very excited about using the song.
Really?
Yeah.
It works. I think it's great.
Yeah, I think it goes along with all the rule breaking that's happening to make you feel that this is not normal. This is not a regular episode of The West Wing.
Also, for all the concern, the sort of comic dad concern that President Bartlett has about Zoe's security detail, this is a pretty catastrophic performance on their part, right? I mean, under their very eyes, her boyfriend drugs her,
yeah,
doses her, one of the agents is killed, and they abduct the president's
tough day.
Daughter.
Tough day.
Papa Smurf?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. No, I don't think you need to be a big expert to know that if the first daughter gets kidnapped, someone has screwed up. But... you know, actually goes back to that scene we were talking about a while ago. The idea that you would send her overseas or something like with just 3 agents is way under manpower protection. There's no one on the back door. She floats off into the restroom, kind of unprotected. They miss her for a while.
This all sounds like euphemisms, but
yeah, no. So yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely kind of a bit of a setup for what happens.
But do you have a sense, would she even be allowed into a techno club? Is that even a viable situation for somebody with that kind of security detail to be under? Is there a way? I love the way it's shot, and there's the Steadicam, and every now and then there's just somebody talking into their wrist.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. The children of both the vice president and the president live normal social lives. They do things. They go to graduation parties. But, you know...
Take ecstasy.
I don't know about the ecstasy part. But
one of the agents named Molly.
One of the,
that was just a little wink, wink.
Yeah. But what's weird here is the weird mix of security and non-security. So Molly says she's counted every single car in the parking lot. There are 189 cars, but they have no idea who's going in and out of this party.
Or where Zoe is.
So it just seems like this kind of weird mix of like hyper-specific security and then like no one watching her at all as she disappears. So the odd kind of scenario.
How old is Zoe at this point?
22, I think.
Graduated from college that day, so she's a college graduate, and so it's kind of a weird setup that way, no question about it.
I think the other thing that's so strange about the setup is that the setup has been set up for us word for word back in season one. I'm just going to play this whole thing.
All of season one?
Yeah.
You guys up for it?
Not the whole thing. I'm just going to play. This is from Mr. Willis of Ohio, and to go back to this moment from season one after having just watched this episode, it's a little odd. The president basically dictates the whole scene. Here it is.
The Secret Service should worry about you getting shot.
They are worried about me getting shot. I'm worried about me getting shot. But that is nothing compared to how terrified we are of you. You scare the hell out of the Secret Service, Zoe, and you scare the hell out of me, too. My getting killed would be bad enough. But that is not the nightmare scenario. The nightmare scenario, sweetheart, is you getting kidnapped. You go out to a bar or a party in some club, and you get up to go to the restroom. Somebody comes up from behind, puts their hand across your mouth, and whisks you out the back door. You're so petrified, you don't even notice the bodies of the two Secret Service agents lying on the ground with bullet holes in their heads. Then you're whisked away in a car. It's a big party with lots of noise and lots of people coming and going. And it's a half hour before someone says, "Hey, where's Zoe?"
I don't see the connection.
There's 183 cars in the parking lot. That song from, what's it called, playing?
The futuristic throbbing song. That's pretty dead on.
It is. I mean, I don't know if it's brilliant how it was foreshadowed so specifically and clearly 3 years later, or if it's...
Or if you've wasted your life.
That I know for sure.
Yeah.
Look, I made the people. I made the people who I was watching on TV come and sit up next to me. So. You are here. You are doing my bidding.
So who's the puppet master here?
Who's in charge? You know, one thing about this episode, in all seriousness, is it is Aaron's, when his skill is infused with something he feels deeply. And I always felt like this is, the writing of this is fueled by his worry for his daughter.
I think the story of what happens in this episode is also adds so much to the title. It actually completely transforms the title for me. We know Zoe's graduating before the episode starts, and so calling it commencement seems like a matter of fact, just a run-of-the-mill kind of even unremarkable choice. But then by the end, when we have no idea what's happened to Zoe, no idea where she is or who did it or why, we don't even get to see Leo give the president the news by the end. Suddenly the title commencement becomes this ominous word that this is just the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Oh. I think Rishi won that last round.
Yeah.
Knockout.
I think it's an interesting choice to not show Leo telling, because I think often in situations like that, the more pedestrian instinct to like show this horrible scene, it's much more horrific if the audience can imagine it.
We talked about the incongruity of seeing John Spencer run. There's another image that we've just never seen before, and that's Michael O'Neill as Ron Butterfield. He's huffing and puffing and ruddy and looks like he's about to cry. And just
Michael O'Neill is so wonderful.
Yeah. The guy's he's a fantastic actor, and I like that in that image, we can see through President Bartlett's eyes. He knows there's some very, very, very bad news coming.
It's a big cardio episode.
It's true.
That's about our time, unless anybody has anything else they want to...
Oh, did it split? Wow.
Amazing.
Holy moly.
Thank you.
I can't get even close to doing that, and I'm still in my 50s.
Well, that just about wraps it up for this episode.
And where do you go from there?
We say the Western Weekly is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a curated collection of fiercely independent podcasts.
If you want to check out the other podcasts, you can go to radiotopia.fm.
I don't believe you.
We want to thank, as always, Margaret Miller, who helps us make this episode, and Zach McNeese, who's here tonight.
Zach McNeese is in the house.
Thanks to everyone here at the Lincoln Theater. Thanks to all of you for coming. And thanks so much to our amazing trio of guests, Melissa Fitzgerald, Ronald Klain, and Bradley Whitford. We're so happy to be here. We're so happy that you all came. Okay.
Okay.
Melissa, seriously, I can't, I don't even understand what just happened to me this evening. You better call me, bitch. And I can't believe I was on a podcast and had no idea and swore like a truck driver. All right, well, call me.
Radiotopia from PR.